there. Welcome back. Good day to you all, to all our listeners, wherever you are from. I hope you had a good weekend and that you're up for another interesting discussion here on Red Ice Radio. My name is Henrik. Our websites, redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com, is where we have more for you. We come to you three times per week and we cover a vast array of topics that we consider to be interesting and important to know more about. Our guests today is Brian Forster and L.A. Marzulli on the DNA analysis, the results from one of the Paracas elongated skulls. This has been a big story now in the last couple of weeks, and we are going to try to unravel what it points to. Brian Forster is a professional sculptor and author of 8 books. He is known for his research on the megalithic sites of South America. He is also the assistant director of the Paracas History Museum in the south of Lima. And he's been leading the most recent investigation into the elongated skulls. Then we have L.A. Marzulli. He is the author of the Nephilim trilogy. He has also teamed up with film producer Richard Shaw to create the Watcher series. Marzulli's latest book, The Cosmic Chess Match, was released in the fall of 2011. Welcome, Brian. Thanks for coming back again. Nice to have you back so soon, actually. Hope you've been well since we last spoke.
Oh, thank you very much. It's always an honor, Henrik.
Thank you, Brian. And L.A. Marzulli as well. Nice to talk with you again. It was a while ago, I think a couple of years at least, so it's nice to have you back again.
Absolutely, Henrik. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You bet, you bet. So a lot of interesting things have been happening, Brian, since we last spoke, and we want to tie this together into what you've been working on as well, L.A. But Brian, why don't you give us kind of the background a little bit here to the story that we're going to focus on and kind of hinge this around. New, basically, DNA data has been coming in. We published an article on Red Eye, so got a lot of hits on that. A lot of people are really, really interested in this stuff. So tell us what we should know here in the outset, Brian.
Okay, well, basically, some samples were sent to Lloyd Pye about 3 years ago of a Paracas elongated skull. And so they were passed on from him to a geneticist, possibly one of many he's been working with, I'm not sure. The geneticist is not really known to us. But people around the world have found the story intriguing. They've been waiting, as have I, for almost 3 years to get some kind of indication about something. And it wasn't until about a month or a month and a half ago that he actually had something to say about it. The problem has been that we have had no capability to fund him whatsoever, and doing ancient DNA testing is astonishingly expensive. It's not like you going down and having your blood tested for your DNA. It's a very complex process. So it has been only relatively recently that he's been able to find some quite tantalizing initial results.
I mean, there's a lot of skulls, as we've talked about before, Brian. I mean, in the hundreds, I believe. It seems to be less skeletons for some interesting reason, though. But nonetheless, there's so many different skulls out there. Some seems to have the evidence of being, elongated after birth, shall we put it, and some to be elongated naturally, something else, in other words. Where did these particular samples come from that was tested, Brian?
Well, they are from a Paracas skull, from the Paracas culture. So the skull would be at least 2,000 minimum, and possibly as much as 3,000 or more years old.
Wow. All right. And how certain is that they of the dating process, and how is that done on the skull itself directly?
No, it's based on what academics have long felt was the timeline of the Paracas. It's known that they more or less disappeared about 2,000 years ago as the result of either absorption by or extermination by the famous Nazca culture, makers of the lines and geoglyphs. But how far back they go is not known because most of the work on the Paracas was done in the 1920s and 1930s prior to DNA and carbon-14 testing. So that's one thing that I'm really trying to work at is to actually find out how far back this very intriguing culture goes. And as yet, we do have a 3,000-year timeline, but I honestly think they're much older than that.
So what can you say about the people that we know, the culture in general? What area were they in? Did they extend, far and wide in the Andes region? And do you think that they were in contact with, you know, the other tribes at that time, or what do we know about them?
Well, we actually know quite a bit about them through, again, investigations, mainly in the early 1900s. Unfortunately, the Paracas are, and this is actually, I was speaking to the director of archaeology of Peru a few days ago, and she admitted that the Paracas, though they're a reasonably famous culture, are the least understood, just because the resources have not been put to investigate them. The Inca, of course, are super famous, and many other cultures are, but what we do know is that their center was basically where I am now, which is Paracas, about 4 hours' drive south of Lima, the capital of Peru, and their territory expanded eastwards into the foothills of the Andes, massive agricultural area, and then south towards where Nazca itself is.
I see. We can definitely talk a little bit more about, you know, what might have happened and other things related to, you know, what where they come from and their, you know, cultural traits and everything else. But let's switch over to you a little bit, Ella. You've been down in the region as well, I believe, right? You met with Brian and you've been down there as part of your investigations into your own series, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I actually I read Brian and David Childress's book on elongated skulls and watched a few videos, all within probably a 48-hour period, then emailed Brian, and we struck up a conversation, and we had our first expedition a little over a year ago, and it was just mind-boggling. Again, I'm coming at it from a slightly different paradigm than most people. I believe that these may be the remnants of the Nephilim, which we hear about in ancient texts, and having gone down there, looked at the skulls, weighed the skulls, examined the skulls with the first team, and of course, we just returned. We went back again with a different team and did the same type of investigation, actually a little more thorough this time than what we did the first time, and of course thousands of photographs. And then hearing this preliminary DNA evidence, which again is preliminary. I mean, we don't know, and we're attempting right now to maybe actually extract real DNA samples, but we need a Peruvian archaeologist. There's a whole bunch of red tape to do that, yeah. And we're sort of, you know, in the process of trying to get that done. What is interesting is that it seems to fit my paradigm anyway, this initial DNA reporting. And what I mean by that is that's exactly what I would expect to see if these, in fact, were remnant of the Nephilim tribes that we hear about in these ancient biblical texts, the mitochondrial DNA not matching anything. I believe a geneticist said that these they might not have been viable. In other words, they may have found it hard to reproduce. This is exactly it fits the paradigm. Again, it's still way too early to make any hard conclusions as to what we're looking at, but it's going down that road, at least in my opinion, very nicely, and it is fitting the paradigm that perhaps these creatures, whatever they were, not only were in Paracas, but we're also in North America, and I've been at many different sites in the North American continent, and most of these sites have been picked over and completely controlled by powers that be. That's another conversation. But there are, if I was just looking at a picture taken in the 1920s by an amateur archaeologist by the name of Ralph Glidden out in Catalina, and this picture has never been shown to the public before. It'll be in my new book, On the Trail of a Nephilim too. But what's interesting about this, and I've shown the picture to Brian, I think you'll know what I'm talking about. There is an elongated skull in this one picture. It looks like, and it's hard to tell because it's a picture, but it looks like a female and a small child, maybe 2 years old. Well, the adult skull goes straight back from the brow line. Very, very odd. It's not a Native American. It's very elongated and not up like a cone head, but way back. And we've seen skulls like this in Paracas. What's intriguing is the 1-year-old child or 18-month-old child that's there buried along with this. And this is a classic cone head of what we saw in places like Ouattara. In fact, if I were to take a section of that and just show that one skull and AB it to the Ouattara skull, you'd say, well, would they come in the same place? No, they're separated by thousands of miles. Once again, in my opinion, this fits the paradigm that there was a diaspora, if I can use that word, from the Levant, from the Promised Land. these creatures moved up in through Europe, came into the Americas, settled through the Americas, and spread out. They also built boats, in my opinion, and sailed across the Atlantic and settled in different places, specifically in Paracas, Peru. And that's the theory. That's the hypothesis that we're going on.
Well, very interesting. What kind of burial, Brian, are we talking about here? How were they found? And is that homogenous throughout the field, if you will?
Well, definitely. The thing is that there are, in the Archaeology Museum in Lima, which is the national museum, they have 300 complete mummy bundles of the Paracas, which are not available to see by the public. But there are hundreds, if not thousands, of these elongated skulls, which are in museum collections all over the world. I was just reading a scientific article today that said that in one museum collection in Paris alone, there are 500 of them. So it's not like the, for example, the Star Child skull, where they've only found one. There are thousands of these elongated skulls. And so what I've been doing over the last 4 years is, through the little Paracas History Museum that we have, we've collected about 40 of them. And it's important to have a good number of samples so that you can make comparative analysis of them. The majority of them look like they are examples of cranial deformation, which was a ceremonial practice, but about 5% of them appear to be very natural looking, in that their shape is so complicated that it would be very difficult for a so-called primitive society to bind a skull like that and make it the shape that it is. Basically, some of them literally look like they were born that way. And that's why my interest started to turn to, well, I think some, carbon-14 and DNA analysis should be done on the Paracas culture.
Indeed. Now, what has the DNA analysis said, tell us so far, and what is left in this process? As always, I mean, we spoke with the late Lloyd Pye, of course, many times about this and the testing that he was doing on the Star Child skull. And it's always, there's always more to learn. There's always more tests that could be done. It's the process could be somewhat difficult if the samples are all old or even more in trouble in that regard. But what has come out so far then?
Well, actually, I can read you the exact email that I got from the geneticist. And it says this: whatever the sample labeled 3A has come from, it had mitochondrial DNA with mutations unknown in any human, primate, or animal known so far. The data are very sketchy, though, and a lot of sequencing still needs to be done to recover the complete mitochondrial DNA sequence. But a few fragments I was able to sequence from this sample 3A indicate that if these mutations will hold, we are dealing with a new human-like creature, very different and distant from Homo sapiens, Neanderthal, and Denisovans. I'm not sure it will even fit into the known evolutionary tree. The question is, if they are so different, they could not interbreed with humans. Breeding within their small population, they may have degenerated due to inbreeding. That would explain buried children. They were either low or not viable. We need to get serious funding to make a big bang. And that's directly from his email.
And you can't disclose who has given you this at this point, is that correct?
No, I can't. And it's mainly because he, at this point, doesn't want to be exposed to the public. Because, again, this has gone from being something which was a curious examination to a very scientific study. And so when you're performing a scientific study, you can't release, you should not release initial results at all. But I did this because I thought the public would want to know that we're onto something intriguing. But he has stated that he would be very willing to let the public know who he is once he's been able to replicate the information multiple times, and then he wants to write his own peer-reviewable paper in regards to this subject.
I see. Now, do you know how it works in terms of sequencing, in terms of what database they actually correlate the findings with? And I mean, is it is this an NIH like a kind of database that they plug this into and compare it, or how does that work? Do you know?
Yeah, there is a database which is called GenBank, and it contains all of the decoded DNA of all life forms that they've done so far. So what he does, and what any geneticist would do, is they send the segments that they have, or the information that they have, to GenBank, and a computer compares that DNA with what is available in GenBank. And so, through cross comparison analysis, they are able to, find out, is it Homo sapiens? And then from there, they can also figure out what haplotypes, as in what parts of the world someone's DNA comes from, etc. So the fact that he is treating this in such a serious manner is why I released these initial results to the public, because I was in complete shock for 2 days and had to keep rereading the email over and over again, making sure that I understood what was going on. And I was in constant communication with LA as well, who was equally confused.
Well, exactly. Well, it's really interesting. I mean, it doesn't necessarily say though that this is alien, of course, in that regard. It's just that the data that's come in is unknown to this extent, and it could just be, it could be another type of humanoid or something like that, or of course it could be a trace of genetic intermingling at a later date or earlier date rather, by something else from somewhere else. But what do you make of this, Marzulli? How do you interpret some of this data here?
Well, I think it's fair to state, let me back up. I think it's fair to state that even though all the evidence is not in yet, and I've talked about this constantly, and I think Brian will agree, there seems to be an outside agency that's manipulating the genome on some level. Somebody is messing with the genome on some level, because we have the evidence, and it seems to be worldwide. Look, we've got it in North America. It's not like South America, like Peru, where you can go and, oh my gosh, here are the skulls. Many of the stuff up here in my neck of the woods, as it were, has been taken by the Smithsonian and different museums, and you can't see doodly squat. And even the stuff that was the pictures that I have from the 20s and 30s, those skeletons are gone. No one knows where they are. We've got pictures of them, okay? And they're not Photoshopped. I mean, they're the real deal. But as far as the actual skeletons, we have no idea. When I've spoken to Native American war chiefs in this country, their oral tradition states that there was a race of red-haired giants that preceded them. That's what they had to fight against them. And many of these red-haired giants were cannibals. And of course, mainstream archaeology looks at this and says, oh, isn't that a nice little bedtime story? And they never talk about it. But in my opinion, it's sort of incredible that they would take that position, because these people, these Native Americans, have passed this oral tradition down literally for hundreds and hundreds of years, from grandson, grandfather to grandson, or father to son, whatever. And when you sit down with these people, like I have, and you hear the oral tradition, they are telling stories that go way, way back. And the stories are always the same. There was a race of red-haired giants that were here. They were tall. They were not like human beings. And we hear this over and over and over again. Look, I can go back 2,000 years to the Jewish historian Josephus, who talks about the Nephilim. And it's one of the few extra-biblical writings that we have about these creatures. And he talks about them, and he says that the skeletons of these beings were openly on display in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. So all this, in my opinion, fits the paradigm that when the biblical account of Joshua and Caleb going into what is known as the Levant, or the Promised Land, there's all these Nephilim creatures there. There's a whole series of tribes that are there, and these tribes are listed. And so they start to get wiped out. Many of them flee. They build boats. They flee across the Atlantic. They go northward, come across in the Americas, and settle here. Look, we've got edifices here in the Americas that don't make any sense, specifically the Great Circle Mound in Ohio. Native Americans did not build that. Many tribes will even state openly, it was here when we got here. But the mainstream archaeologists, it doesn't fit, doesn't jibe into their into their paradigm, so they dismiss all that. What we do know is that in the latter part of the 19th century into the 20th century, 8, 9, and 10 footers were pulled out of these mounds. I spent 2 or 3 days at the Madison, Wisconsin Historical Museum. I was looking at photographs of the original transcripts, and then I actually got some of the original transcripts, okay, the letters from the these guys called the Phillips brothers, who were at a site called Lake Delavan in Wisconsin, and the curator of the museum. And these guys, the Phillips brothers, they're just, you know, this is like 1911, okay? So it's really before we have modern-day archaeology, way, way before that. And the Phillips brothers are going, look, these aren't Native Americans. There's something else. The skulls don't match. They go from the brow ridge straight back. They're not Native American. And it's funny because, you know, the curator and the archaeologist is there is desperately trying to convince them that they don't know what they're seeing. Now, I believe that there's photographs of those, but they're not in the archives. Nothing is there. What's interesting to me is their description fits what I did see and took a photograph of the photograph out in Catalina and does fit of some of the skulls that I saw down in Peru. So it's, you know, I think bottom line for me, got a little long-winded here in this segment, is that an outside agency is manipulating the genome.
Right. We talked about Catalina a while back with another guest as well. There's just some fascinating finds there. I mean, it's incredible. And the as you say, the cover-up from the point of view of Smithsonian and everything else. And there are a couple of other sources here as well. I'm going to bring up one of them later to you guys and see what you think about that, because there are other, you know, they basically correlate the Nephilim stories, although they're not kind of put in that context with those names necessarily. But Brian, are you able to determine at this point then what skulls are, you know, human genetically speaking, and you know, how many others are not, you know? And again, they will match this unknown DNA, which is at this point unknown, at least.
Well, again, it seems to be about, you know, morphologically or looking at them, about 5% are very curious. And through the research that David Childress and I did in our first book, The Enigma of Cranial Deformation, we looked at the global phenomenon of cranial deformation and the existence of elongated skulls. And from a couple of scientific articles I was reading today, it was even more widespread than I thought could possibly be imaginable. It was literally all over the world, this phenomenon, especially about 2,000 years ago. But there are skulls that have been found that have been cranially deformed from the area of Iraq that go back at least 30,000 years. But my major focus has been Peru and Bolivia, because this is where I spend almost all of my time. And my more particular focus has been the Paracas area, but also up around Cusco, because a lot of elongated skulls have been found there as well. And so the main thing is it's trying to trace back in time to find the original ones, if possible, because they would be the rootstock from which all of the others came from. And it's our strong belief that the, you know, cranial deformation was a process in order to replicate the look of someone, because that was the international, you know, if you can boil cranial deformation or elongated skulls down in any culture down to three basic points. The first point was that it was believed that it made the children more attractive. Number two, it was believed it made them more intelligent. And number three, that is what the ancestors looked like. And cranial deformation, at least in Peru and Bolivia, was only practiced amongst the royal families. It was not that the entire population was this. It was only a very exclusive genetic bloodline that had this characteristic, whether ceremonial or through natural cause.
Do you believe that they were, you know, again, a possibility here then out of the Middle East, Iraq area kind of thing, coming out of there, traveling potentially around to different parts of the world, maybe even, you know, following a certain route, maybe, you know, of course, not all of them left. They might even have spread globally in that regard. But how do you think that they came from wherever they actually did come from over to the Paracas region, Brian?
Well, that's a great question. And the thing is, even when we were, again, in the director's office of the Museum of Archaeology in Lima a few days ago, they honestly don't know where the Paracas came from, literally. Their civilization rises about 1000 BC. Their artistic abilities, which were really advanced, including, it's quite possible they had the potter's wheel, which no other Native American group that I know of had, all of a sudden they appear in this area. And so it's quite mysterious. And along with the fact that this royal bloodline had auburn red hair, which we've shown is genetically red. It's not dye or sun bleaching or the result of age. And so I'm starting to piece together a global picture of migration patterns. And it's only kind of a gut feeling now, but through conversation with LA, we've noticed there were a lot of elongated skulls in the Middle East and also in the area of Georgia as well. And so I kind of think that we're going to find a bloodline, at least one or more aspects of the bloodline coming from somewhere in the Middle East. And if you study the wind and current patterns of the Pacific Ocean or global oceans in general, then you can see that it is conceivable that ancient people could have sailed from the Middle East through the Pacific to the coast of South America.
Right. Yeah. Now, there's a couple of pictures there, I believe, that actually you can literally see the hair on the skull as well. Is that intact, or is that put on afterwards? Is that the real deal right there?
No, it's intact, because the thing is, the Paracas area is amongst the driest places on Earth. It's actually an extension of what is called the Atacama Desert of Chile. And so Paracas gets less than 1 inch of rain per year, and it's all sandy area, and as well, this area is uplifted ancient ocean, so there's still a lot of salt in the sand itself. So in terms of preservation, it's probably even better than an area like Egypt. So textiles, human skeletal parts are incredibly well preserved, and I've witnessed both in the museum and also in the field, where I go quite often, numerous skulls that have intact, complete hairstyles on them. And they are this beautiful, unique auburn red. It's not like Irish or Scottish red hair. It's a darker, fiery color.
Interesting. When I look at it, it reminds me a little bit about the bog people that have been found primarily in Denmark, England, Netherlands, I think a couple of in Sweden as well, where the head is, the hair is preserved rather. You can even see like the Subian knots and the hairstyle and everything else in there. It's really interesting. And a lot of them also have that have a red hair. Now, if it's matching that you're talking about, if it's a richer one, if you will, I don't know if that's a correlation, but we could talk more about that later. But it's nonetheless very interesting. Did you, LA, when you were down there, did you hold one of these in your hands? Did you look at them properly?
Yeah, that's to say we handled them is an understatement. we measured, weighed, handled them, photographed them. We actually had a dentist from Peru come in and take a look at the dentition. We've done casting of these skulls. In fact, right behind me, we have a cast of one of the elongated skulls. I've shown that to many doctors and dentists and forensic anthropologists here. We took a sample of the hair, just a very small sample of the hair, and it had fallen off one particular skull. And what we wanted to do was to find out whether it was dyed or not. So we took it back to the States, and this is where it gets really strange. And there's a machine called Raman spectroscopy, and you can take different objects and put it. And what this machine will do is it will analyze whatever you're putting in it and tell you on a graph, plot it on a graph, what it's sort of made out of, its molecular structure. So what was interesting is we had four samples. We had a normal human hair from modernity. We had a normal human hair from present day that was dyed. Okay, so that's one and two. Normal human hair, dyed human hair. We had the Paracas red hair. And then number four, and this is where we not in Kansas anymore type of deal, the particular gentleman who was running this is also very involved in the UFO abduction phenomena. And excuse me, he was given in his possession by a man who had been abducted and forced to have sex with a hybrid being with very white blondish hair. All right?
Right.
So we have four hairs. We have the human hair, the dyed human hair, the red hair from Paracas, and this white hair from supposedly some sort of a hybrid being. All of them ran through Raman spectroscopy. The human hair starts about midway up the graph on the left side, does a nice little arc, and then kind of comes down. The dyed human hair starts at about the same place, but the arc is totally different. It shoots up to the very top in a very dramatic, long arc. So they're completely different. The dyed hair is totally different looking on the Raman spectroscopy graph than the normal human hair. But here's where it gets really interesting. And when we saw this, the man who was doing a test fell out of his chair. And when he explained it to us, we promptly fell out of our chairs too. When you take the Raman spectroscopy reading for the Paracas red hair and the so-called whitish hair from the hybrid, female hybrid being, and you plot those on a graph, they basically track almost identically with one another. The slopes are almost the same. You can juxtapose them one upon the other. That's how close they are. And that blew us away because, again, what it does from my particular paradigm, it brings what was happening then, thousands of years ago in antiquity, and all of a sudden there's a leap, a scientific leap, into modernity, and there seems to be a relation between the hair from the hybrid being today and you know, present day, and the red hair from Paracas. Now, look, that's not conclusive, but it's certainly absolutely mind-boggling. And once again, it sort of leads us down the road that there is an outside agency messing with the genome.
Well, that is interesting. That's indeed very interesting. Now, we could talk a little bit about, there might be some difference obviously here in the general outlook of, you know, where they come from, even what the purpose of them were in that regard. But if we switch back to you, Brian, to a certain extent here, do you believe that they were, we're talking about a race of that became the king race, if you will, because of their appearance and everything. And then we obviously have a scenario here where, you know, so-called regular Norman humans, when they dyed their hair, they shaped their skulls to look like these beings, to kind of be part of that line as well. And who do you think they were? They were like the kings and the royals of that area?
Well, they definitely were the royal family of the area, because the tombs that they've been found in have been rich in very incredible ornate tapestries, fine ceramics, etc. And that's typical anywhere in the world where you find royal tombs. You tend to find very nice artifacts, whereas a farmer's grave will tend to have not much in it. So we do know that they were of a royal class. Part of the mystery is that when the Nazca take over the area, which was about 100 AD, all of the sudden the elongated skulls disappear from the archaeological record. They're not really found that much amongst the Nazca tombs. And so it's my beginning of a theory that I think the Nazca, in fact, eradicated the royal family of the Paracas for some reason. But I can't understand why you wouldn't find the Paracas in the archaeological record once the Nazca take over. However, when we look, the thing is that this phenomenon existed all over Peru and also in the area of many parts of Bolivia, including Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, and other sites in Peru where you find megalithic structures. I'm starting to find direct correlations between megalithic building and the presence of elongated skulls.
Well, that's interesting. Do you believe that they were, the Nazca people were threatened to a certain extent? I mean, it's not something new to see, people in a close proximity being at war in the ancient times. You know, this is just how things were, but it might be a potential turf war. They wanted to take over the region. They might even wanted to have controlled some of these, different looking peoples, perhaps.
Well, that's very true. And what we do know from records is that, are not necessarily records, but studies of what the climate was like, is that around 100 AD, the whole coastal area of Peru began to become desert. And so that, of course, forces migration. So what is likely is that the Nazca or proto-Nazca people were forced out of their area due to lack of agriculture, moved into the lush area of the Paracas, and decided to basically take over. And then by 600 AD, the Nazca themselves were the victims of a continuing desertification. So that is what we know. Another thing we could discuss in the interview is the famous Nazca lines and geoglyphs, because that also I've been doing extensive investigation of.
Okay, yeah, let's keep that in mind. We'll return to that. Now, is it, you talk, I think you mentioned a little bit somewhere as well in terms of seafaring. Was there any, you know, evidence of boats or being, you know, kind of have a maritime connection with any, either the Nazca or the Paracas people?
Well, the Paracas most likely did. The Nazca, not so much, because the Nazca, even when they took over the area, they were more inland than they were coastal. But on the coast of Peru, in the Paracas area, you find indigenous totora reed, which is also found in Lake Titicaca and also on Easter Island, funnily enough. And you also have native cotton, which has been here for at least 9,000 years. And so in Lake Titicaca, for thousands of years, people have constructed small boats and even large, almost double hull sailing craft. So it's quite plausible that the Paracas were able to as well utilize the totora and cotton and build large reed vessels in order to be able to not only fish, but also hunt sea mammals, because in the archaeological record, we find sea lions and also the remnants of whales. And whales, unless they land on the beach, are not exactly easy prey. So to hunt a whale requires a very sophisticated knowledge of the ocean and probably sailing skills, because you wouldn't be able to paddle fast enough to catch them. So also there are, we have in the archaeological record a lot of shell material, which is only found off the coast of Ecuador. So the Paracas were obviously trading with Ecuadorian people at least 2,000 years ago. And it's a lot easier to sail on the strong winds that go from the south up the coast, and then during calmer times reverse and come south, than it is to walk to Ecuador and back.
Huh. Interesting. Now, do you believe that it could be any alien genetics in this picture here, Brian?
Well, I honestly don't want to go that far, because what we have to do is we have to establish what aspects of humanity there are. There have to be a lot more samples taken and then compared with what is in GenBank. So the bottom line question for me is, number one, are these people 100% Native American genetically from this area, or does the situation get more complicated? And I've already found out from a German paper written by geneticists 4 years ago that there is no true genetic connection between people of the coast of Peru, especially the Paracas, and the people of the highlands of Peru. And so with that genetic difference, that for me is intriguing enough. But even prior to the initial release of findings that the geneticist sent to me, he also found what he believes are Northern European genes or segments of genes in the Paracas, again, based only on possibly one sampling. But what's important about that concept is you're not necessarily talking about Vikings traveling to South America, but if you look at where Nordic people come from, genetically to a great extent, or at least to some extent, they come from the Middle East, because that's where red hair and blonde hair comes from. It doesn't, you know, it didn't suddenly rise up in Norway and Sweden, etc. You find significant populations to this day in places like Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan, that have reddish hair, reddish beards, and even blonde hair, blue eyes, and green eyes. And those characteristics, when you look at the global population, red hair is very, very small, and blonde hair, not to as much a great extent, but also green eyes and blue eyes are very small as a percentage of the global human population.
Well, exactly. And there's a number of interesting just historical accounts of it. You know, Greek writers have talked about redheaded people. They Xenophanes described that the Thracians were blue-eyed and red hair. Herodotus talked about the Budini people, which is kind of where they come from. They were kind of Sarmatian, kind of in that region, or Fenno-Ugric, which would be like kind of a Finnic, and then further south from Finland kind of people, you know. And that there's just so many more. There's even the Queen Iceni, I think, that from the ancient Britons that they mentioned were, well, she was actually tall as well, which is kind of gets us into the giant aspects a little bit. But she had a great mass of red hair over her shoulders, and she was tall and terrifying, apparently, and even in appearance, you know. And then you have Gaulish tribes, Getish tribes. There's a lot of interesting things there. So how is that the clue here, guys? Do you think we could talk about that with you, LA, a little bit, to follow the red-haired traits here, to kind of see where how that has spread throughout the globe? What do you think, LA?
Well, yeah, I think it's certainly something that I find incredibly interesting, and it's certainly done more than pique my interest. There's other characteristics that I think we need to look at into also. The idea of six fingers, six toes. Now, look, normal human beings can have that, polydactylism. I understand that. But we get these ancient accounts of six fingers and six toes. And what's interesting is out in the Americas, we hear the same thing, that some of these tribes of giants had six fingers and six toes. We know this because, again, going back into the 19th and early part of the 20th century, when these mounds were dug into by primitive archaeologists, they found large skeletons, over 9 feet in some cases, six fingers, six toes. So that seems to be a trait. I can't state this enough. I believe that there's an outside agency that's manipulating the genome on some level. And these people may have had, let's say, what we would call superhuman powers. They have the power of telepathy, mind control. Were they able to stop you in your tracks? I mean, who knows? But they were more than likely worshipped as demigods by normal human beings. And this is why, you know, Brian and David did such a wonderful job in their book on elongated skulls. But it begs the question, why get up on a Monday morning and start, you know, binding the heads of all the kids to look like this? What the heck are they emulating? I mean, something's going on here.
Right.
So it's incredibly intriguing. And what really blows my mind is that until really recently, all this was hidden under the rug. I mean, no one talked about it. No one at all. I mean, Brian and David's book really sort of blew the lid off the phenomena. And now it's become, oh my gosh, Nephilim skulls. I mean, what are we really looking at here? But they were in the Americas, and it's important for us to realize that there was not the type of cranial deformation that we see necessarily in Peru, but there were elongated skulls and abnormal skulls found in the Americas, and that's a fact.
Well, exactly. Now, when you handle the skull as well, is it usually unusually larger, or is it kind of about the same size, but it's just kind of sticking out, elongated upwards in the back, or how does it look?
Well, the ones that I handled, and there was a female that we did a cast of, and we actually weighed the skulls and then filled the interior of the skulls with rice to see if the cranial capacity was the same as a normal human being. And what we discovered is that many of the skulls were between 20 and 35%, I'm just giving you an average, greater cranial capacity than that of a normal human being.
So that would kind of point a little bit to a larger kind of a gigantism type, property here, basically.
Absolutely. One of the skulls that I've got a picture of from Catalina, and again, no one has seen this. It'll be public sooner than later, probably this year, sometime in May or June when the book comes out. But this guy, and I had three independent researchers look at the photograph and extrapolate the measurements from the photograph, because we had a human being standing in the grave. The skeleton was articulated, it was in situ, it was not a bone pile, and so it was quite a find. And we estimate that skeleton at about 8.5 feet, and I'm being conservative. One of the researchers put it at over 9 feet. So I'm just sort of taking the average out of the three and putting this thing at 8.5 feet. And of course, the problem with that is it does not fit the evolutionary paradigm whatsoever. Something is incredibly anomalous here. And what's even more mystifying is it's found on Catalina Island, and the LA Times reported it in their paper, 9-foot skeletons found on Catalina. Well, when you talk to modern day archaeologists here, which I have done, and you go to the archives and UCLA and see the remains of the so-called Gooden collection, it's all Native American and there's nothing anomalous about any of this. And when you talk to a forensic anthropologist and ask them, well, what about Glidden? What about these 9-footers? They laugh at you because that's what they were taught. Okay. But no one has really done the homework. And I got to go out there and I got to look at these records from Glidden and these photographs, which are not on display to the public. Some people have seen them, but certainly not displayed to the general public. And I was able to find evidence not only of a 6-finger skeleton, but other remains which did not fit the Native American paradigm at all, including, of course, that 8.5-footer, which ties back into the LA Times, their story. It's not sensationalistic. Even in Glidden's own records, and you know, it's hard to describe this on air, but looking at his journals, it's line after line of his sketchy handwriting, and he was a man of few words. So he would write, and when he was typing it, it would be like, you know, site number 143, 20 arrowheads, 2 spearheads, one bowl, 3 skeletons. That's it. And it's line after line of that. That's all you read. And all of a sudden, I spent like 10 hours looking at all these journals and going over them, reading them, and looking for stuff. And all of a sudden, one line jumps out at me. And he's on San Miguel Island, and he writes, "Discovered a skeleton today, had to have been well over 8 feet." That's all he says. And then later on, we see this picture of him in a grave, recently excavated. The skeleton is in situ, and that's the one that we were able to extrapolate because Glidden is 5'8". He's in the grave, so we know his height. And from that height, we can extrapolate the skeleton, and that guy is 8.5 feet, and that shouldn't be there. It just doesn't belong there. And it fits the paradigm. It fits the oral tradition of the Chumash and other Native American cultures. It fits the paradigm that some perhaps from the Middle East, these beings migrated and came here and settled here. They were fleeing. There was a diaspora. We don't know that for certain, but that's our hypothesis. And so far, I'm sticking to it.
Now, Brian, are there any hints so far here of giants from the archaeological record from your general area where you've been looking? Or are there any, I guess, myths about unusual large people that we know of? I don't know what has been written down, if anything, from the Paracas people or later tribes, or if something has been carried on as far as we know.
Well, again, the Paracas disappeared more or less as a culture 2,000 years ago. Academics don't even know what language they spoke. They left no oral tradition, no written tradition. I've been in the field quite extensively because some of the royal graveyards are open to the public, but they are accessible, especially since I'm connected with the Paracas History Museum. So the largest femurs I've found so far, if you extrapolate from them, which is what forensic scientists do, because the femur is really the only bone you can use. You can't use a finger and try to extrapolate the size of the skeleton. But some of the Paracas seem to have been 5'10", 6 feet, or maybe 6'2". And that, of course, doesn't sound like a giant. However, when you take into account that other people in antiquity living in the area averaged about 5'3", or maybe 5'4". They were relatively tall in comparison to other cultures.
Very, very good. Now, we have much more to discuss, of course. I want to talk a little bit, mention your websites and such before we take a break here and whatever else you have, you know, going on right now. But let me ask you one more thing, Brian, then. What is the next step here in terms of what is left to be done, and how long could this go on for, do you think, in terms of finding a conclusive data or genetic data on this particular skull?
Well, it will take years, if not decades, basically, because again, we have an initial result, and as a result of that initial result, we have to be able to substantiate whether it's authentic or not. It would not be some kind of contamination from bacteria, because that's the first thing that a geneticist is able to remove, is what bacterial DNA looks like. And so the computer automatically removes anything like that from it. What I would like to see done, and we're working on, is we now have a Peruvian archaeologist who is going to be working with us. We have great response from the Museum of Archaeology in Lima, who very much would like to have DNA testing and carbon-14 testing done, not only of the Paracas, but also of other interesting cultures or areas where you find elongated skulls, such as around Cusco and in Bolivia, Tiwanaku and Pumapunku, because they simply haven't been able to put the resources together, but they're very open to having establishments in the United States work with them on a institution-to-institution or government-to-government level to do this. And then eventually I would like to see a global database where we can do testing of elongated skulls from Iraq from and other parts of the world where these have been found. They've been found throughout Europe. They've been found in Melanesia. They've been found in Central America. And the list actually is much longer than I could possibly make. It was a global phenomenon. And why, as LA said, why would so many different cultures try to emulate one or two particular kinds of looks like that? It will take decades, and I am dedicated to this pursuit.
Well, that would be a really interesting and a good suggestion in terms of a database, kind of a correlation and checking and starting to find kind of a genetic reference point here and see possibly movements of these people, you know, and again, how much do they differ? Are they from here natively? Are they not? Is it genetic tampering? There's, I mean, just a slew of questions to be answered on top of this, of course. But Brian, before we break here, then I want to ask you the same later here, LA, but how can people follow your work, Brian? Let us know if you have something, you know, upcoming or something else you'd like to notify our listeners about here.
Well, sure. My main website is hiddenincatours.com. I'm, of course, also on Facebook, and we do have an upcoming tour happening beginning March 30th, which is in Egypt, looking at lost ancient technology with Stephen Mailer. And then after that, LA and I have a tour in Peru looking at the elongated skulls, and that's in May. Both of those tours you can see on the homepage of my website.
Right, very good. LA, you have a new series out, of course, on the Nephilim as well that we haven't talked about before. Just tell us a little bit about that, and also give us the website so people know how to find you and follow you.
Sure, we have the Watcher series, which is a film series 1 through 7, and we're actually working on number 8. Watcher 7 just won the UFO Congress EBE Film Award and the People's Choice Award. So that was last weekend in Phoenix, Arizona. About 1,800 people were there, and George Norrie presented the award to my good friend and co-producer Richard Shaw. And it was really kind of cool to actually get that and actually have the film recognized for our work in the UFO phenomena. And there's 7 of these now. We're working on number 8. Number 6, actually, Watchers, was the Hidden Cosmic War. And that was our result of going down and looking at many of these ancient artifacts that Brian showed us. Brian is heavily featured in Watchers 6, of course. We went to places like Cusco and Ollantaytambo and in Huatara and other places and saw just incredible things. And that's all in Watchers 6. The book On the Trail of a Nephilim is sort of the book version of that, and that's an oversized book. It's 8.5 by 11, and it's got over 120 full color pictures. Because what I didn't want to do, you know how some of those books are, you know, you get a little book and all the pictures are in the middle and you can't really see them and they're in black and white. Well, what we wanted to do is really give the reader a feel of what we saw there. And so all these are four color, you know, print on oversized paper. And the best place to get it is lamarzulli.net, lamarzulli.net. And you can avail yourself of this information.
All right, lamarzulli.net and also hiddenincatours.com. We're going to have the websites up for you guys there, but we'll take a little break here. So stay with us, gentlemen. We'll be right back with more after this.
I feel a song coming. Down in Goblin Town. quiver and shake. You can yell and yelp, but there ain't